From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network, Dr. Ian Larson from Monash University in Australia is interviewed by Gen's editor-in-chief John Sterling about a nano-sized Trojan horse for the novel delivery of drugs and other molecules.
Dr. Ian Larson is senior lecturer in pharmaceutics and formulation science at Monash University. His research interests include biopolymer drug delivery systems and dry particle behavior and characterization. Dr. Larson, thanks for taking the time to talk to us. You and your colleagues have designed a nano-sized particle to ensure that antioxidants and therapeutic drugs can be better absorbed by the human body. Would you describe this nanoparticle?
The particle that we're using has also been used by other groups. It is made of a biopolymer called chitosan, which is a derivative of what crab shells are made from, which is chitin. This chitosan is water-soluble, and it's a polymer, which is positively charged when you dissolve it in water. We then add what is effectively a cross-linking agent, which is a small negatively charged ion, which basically, just through the fact that it gets attracted to all the positive charges on the polymer, attracts and holds it together to form a particle.
What is the importance of antioxidants, and why might the nanoparticle delivery route be the preferred way to administer the compounds?
Of course, there are other types of particles. I don't need to be nanoparticles to deliver the antioxidants. The advantages of nanoparticles is that we end up with, well, because they're nanoparticles, they're about a thousandth the width of a human hair, then we can incorporate them, or we could incorporate them, in foodstuffs without you noticing that they're there. So you could put them in spreads or in breads or in many processed foods or cooked foods, and you'd never know they're there. So if we had larger particles, macro particles, or sometimes they're called microparticles, which are perhaps the size of a grain of rice, then it's hard to hide them in a food or a beverage, whereas because these are nanoparticles, then we can easily add them to foods in preparation, and we're not aware that they're in there. So the nanoparticle side of things is basically for the sort of the end use, in that their incorporation in foods and beverages wouldn't be noticed by the consumer.
How specifically does your nanoparticle delivery system work?
It works by protecting the antioxidant inside it. So as the nanoparticle goes through as we swallow it and it goes through our stomach is very acidic, it's like battery acid. The nanoparticle protects the antioxidant from the acid. As then the nanoparticle moves through to our intestine is full of enzymes which normally degrade food. It also protects the antioxidants from being degraded by the enzymes. And the nanoparticle is actually adhesive, or it's adhesive to the intestinal walls. So it comes in contact with the intestinal walls and sticks there. It can actually penetrate through the soft mucus layer on the intestinal wall to get through to the actual cells that line our intestine. And that's away from the enzymes, which are out in the middle of the intestine, gradually breaking all the foodstuffs down. So we have a nanoparticle highly loaded with the antioxidant right next to the cells which carry the blood through the body. So the drug can, the antioxidant can then diffuse out the nanoparticle, diffuse through or between the cells and enter our bloodstream, which is then where they get carried around their body and have their pharmacological effect. So the nanoparticle works as both a protection system, in that it protects the antioxidant from the acid and from the enzymes, but it also is small enough that it can get through and make intimate contact with the cells on the other side of which is the blood. And the antioxidant, to have its effect, needs to get into the blood. So it's two reasons why these nanoparticles offer benefits over just delivering antioxidants by themselves, unprotected.
What other types of molecules or drugs might be administered via your nanoparticle delivery system?
Well, we can basically deliver anything, any molecule or drug, which is water-soluble. these nanoparticles are made in an aqueous-based system, and so therefore then the drug or the antioxidant or the molecule which to deliver needs to be soluble in water. Other than that, then one, if we get it dissolved in water, then we can encapsulate it in a nanoparticle, and then we can deliver it through to the small intestine where drugs and molecules get absorbed into the body. So as long as the water, as long as the molecule or the drug is water soluble, then it can be protected in this nanoparticle system.
How far along are you in this research on these nanoparticle delivery systems? Is it this early stage, middle stage, or have you been working on this for quite a while?
We're probably at what I would say is the middle stage, where you can now easily make the nanoparticles. We've now measured the protection and the release of the antioxidants from the nanoparticles. The next step is to go into animal trials. Of course, we've done everything in beakers and in glassware, and we can mimic the acid conditions in the stomach. We can mimic the conditions in the intestine, and we do all that in glassware. Once, and the nanoparticles are performing above expectations. The next step is to conduct animal trials, at which time they'll be administered to animals, and we'll be able to measure their effect in a real live system rather than just in a glassware beaker-based system.
Do you have a time horizon for that, working with the animals?
The animal trials are starting January next year, and will probably take about 6 months to a year to complete.
I understand that you are also working on drug delivery systems involving inhalation medication as well as liquid crystalline injections. What can you tell us about research in these two areas?
With the inhalation medication, so certainly in America and in some other countries, the main form of treatment for asthma is by inhaling a dry powder. In not so many years ago, it was a propellant-based system, which was basically like a spray can, which had the drug dissolved in a volatile solvent, and then you would spray that into your mouth and inhale it. That is gradually being phased out, and now we're the industry is supplying us with systems which are dry powders, so there's a mixture of drug and other components which are in a capsule or a blister pack as a powder. You put that capsule or blister pack in a device, and then you suck on the device and you inhale that dry powder. Now, this is very good from an industrial point of view because the chemical stability of drugs and inert compounds is very high when there is a dry powder. There's no moisture, there's perhaps no light from them for in a blister pack. So it's very good from an industrial point of view, but these systems aren't very efficient. Perhaps the commercially available ones that are generally used for the treatment of asthma, for example, are, say, around 20% efficient. So 20% of the drug that's in the device, only 20% makes it to have any effect on your body. So this is okay if the drug is relatively cheap, because then we can afford to be wasting 80%. And it's okay if the drug is not so toxic that it wouldn't matter if one day we got 25% or 30% instead of 20%. So there's a lot of effort. We're putting a lot of effort, and other groups around the world are also putting effort in trying to improve that efficiency through understanding the way that these powders disperse in air. And perhaps then, if we understand that, then we can design drug particles so that they'll disperse better in air, so that we can change that 20% efficiency to perhaps maybe 70, 80 or 90% efficiency. So then, of course, that's costing the pharmaceutical company much less because they need to put in less drug. And then also there's less of a chance. If you're already delivering 90%, then even if one day you get 95%, that's only an increase from 90 to 95. That hasn't had a very big impact upon the total load that's entering your body. So we're putting a lot of work into inhalation medication. We're not involved in discovering new drugs. We're involved in improving the efficiency of delivery of existing medications for both asthma-type diseases and also for lung infections, such as you might find in patients who've got pneumonia. With the liquid crystalline work, we're doing so liquid crystals, soap-like or surfactant-like molecules that self-assemble in liquids, and they form structures which are both crystalline in that they have long-range order, but liquid in the fact that you can pour them and they have viscosity. This is only very, very new research, liquid crystalline materials in pharmaceutics. We're partially down the track. We've done some work on having liquid crystalline systems where we disperse them into nanometer-sized particles which retain their crystalline structure, which we can load with drug, and then which we can deliver orally. And they form some of the same roles as what our nanoparticle system does, in that it's a protection system. And not only can these liquid crystalline systems protect drug from exterior pH or enzymes, but we can also tailor the structure of the liquid crystalline systems to release the drug at specific rates, so that if we're looking for a controlled release, if we don't want the drug to enter our body in one burst, we want it to trickle into our blood to remain at a therapeutic level for some level of time, then these liquid crystalline systems seem to offer the ability for us to be able to control the release of drugs from them.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.